Rod's Pulse Podcast number 68. Better chemistry through e-learning and more Yale Na'im.
This is Rod's Pulse Podcast, the podcast for faculty and students interested in learning how to use and create podcasts and other e-learning technologies. Welcome back. Hi, this is Rod. Welcome back. That was a short clip from a song called Too Long by Yael Na'im. I played one of her songs two episodes ago. She's the one who gained some fame because she composed and sang the music behind the Apple MacBook Air ad campaign. So I really liked her sound, and I picked out the second song. She had two on the PodSafe Music Network. So I hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned at the end of my podcast and you can hear the full song. Now, before we get started with my main topic today, I want to give you a little bit of news from the Podosphere. It concerns Drexel, Drexel University here in Philadelphia. They've been in the news quite a bit recently, and I'm happy to say that my friend and colleague, Dr. Ken Hartman, who's the academic director of Drexel University Online, recently received the 2008 Leadership and Distance Learning Program Administration Award from the United States Distance Learning Association for his innovative efforts and scholarly research in the field of distance learning. Drexel Online's Master's in Higher Education program is also an award winner for the Best Practices Award from the US DLA. So I have a link in my show notes to the press release. Congratulations, Ken. Now for my main topic today, I recorded an interview with Jean-Claude Bradley. He's the Associate Professor of Chemistry and the e-learning coordinator in the College of Arts and Sciences here at Drexel. Now, I first discovered Dr. Bradley's work quite a few years ago when I was first getting involved with podcasting. He was one of the few educational podcasters that popped up when I was doing a search. So I've been wanting to interview him for a long time, and I finally got the opportunity. I have links on my show notes to his e-learning blog, and also he has an e-learning podcast. Now, he's a chemistry professor, as I mentioned, so his focus is on teaching chemistry through e-learning. So I think you'll enjoy the interview. He's been a trailblazer in terms of using e-learning with teaching chemistry. We talked about a number of things, his open notebook science using blogs and wikis, teaching chemistry with Second Life, and I have a list of several other topics that were mentioned with links in my show notes. So without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Bradley. Jean-Claude, thank you so much for agreeing to spend some time with me and tell my audience a bit about your efforts in podcasting and so on. I have a lot of questions for you, but why don't we just get started by telling my audience a little bit about your background and what you've been doing at Drexel?
Well, I'm a synthetic organic chemist, and I've been at Drexel since 1996. And in that time, I've taught organic chemistry. And over the years, I've basically started to move towards technology, towards making better use of technology. So when WebCT became available, I made use of that to give tests and quizzes and eventually, you know, final exams to my students. And a little bit later, I started to record my lectures using Camtasia software that does the screencasts. So for those who aren't familiar with screencasts, it basically records whatever is on your computer screen plus the audio. So it's actually a pretty good representation of what it's like to be in a live classroom.
I noticed from your website that you got into podcasting, looks like February 2005, is that right? And if so, what yep. led you to that route?
Well, I was making my recordings available to my students as a supplement, you know, to the class. Uh-huh. And what was happening is that I would get, you know, students who weren't actually showing up in class. And what I did is I looked at the performance of those students compared to those who actually were there in person, and the performance was really the same. And so I decided to change the way that I would use my teaching time. So from that point forward, I assigned the recorded lectures, and I used the class time for workshops and for really working with students more one-on-one. So that's basically how I ended up making recordings, now specifically podcasting, around 2005, when, you know, the technology was coming out for subscribing to the feeds. I actually had a student who asked me if there was any way for him to get just the audio content. And at the time, I wasn't, you know, separating them out. And I did a little bit of research and learned how to do podcasting. And, you know, things sort of took off from there. That's how it happened. It was, you know, a student request.
How was this received by your department chairman and by other faculty? Do they think you were an oddball, or how did that go?
Well, you know, some people understand the technology and how to use it. If you've been teaching for a long time, you may not want necessarily, you know, looking to changing it, which is absolutely fine. It's just the technology, and people use it in different ways. I use it in the way, like I said, where I assign recorded lectures. But there are other faculty who still keep a live lecture and then you give it as a supplement. So, it's just a tool, and you basically need to find out how much work it is to use it, and you need to find out what benefits that you and your students can get. But I don't think you're going to have a single way of adopting this technology. It's going to go down to the teacher's learning objectives, and everyone has, you know, slightly different objectives.
That's right. I cover all aspects of podcasting and other e-learning technologies in my podcast. So my audience might, and I'm interested too, in finding out a little bit about how technically you record your podcast. You know, what hardware you use, what software you use. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, I basically use Blogger, Blogspot domain, and put that feed through FeedBurner. You know, that was the way to do it a couple of years ago. That was pretty convenient because you didn't have to learn, you know, any XML or anything. You could just have a blog, put a link to an MP3, and it automatically would create the feed.
Okay, that's once you get your MP3 file. What microphone, what recording software do you use?
I typically use Camtasia. Drexel has a site license, which is very convenient. I use it because we have it available. It's a very good software for editing. It's a little expensive, so if your university doesn't have a license to it, there are other alternatives. You know, there's CamStudio or, you know, some other software. If you're interested in video, if you're only interested in audio, you could probably use Audacity. Because I guess I should be clear about specifying when I talk about podcasting. In the old days, it automatically meant audio, and then after a while, people started to use terms like vodcasting and. So I do both, but originally, yes, it was strictly audio.
Right, right. Have you experimented with different microphones? Do you have a favorite setup or microphone?
No, I prefer actually the built-in microphone on the tablet PCs that I've used. They're typically good enough. The machine that I've been using lately, the microphone is not as sensitive, but Camtasia has a nice feature where you can equalize the volume just with the click of a button. So that's generally good enough for my purposes.
Now, I know we probably won't have time to give it its full due, but I'm very interested in and what I've noticed on your website about your use of open source, open notebook science, using blogs and wikis. So now I guess we're getting into more of the pedagogy and how you go about using those tools. I've talked about the tools a lot, but not so much how to use them practically in a course. Could you tell us how you use blogs and wikis?
Right. Every one of those technologies has its strengths and weaknesses, and it turns out that you need a collection of those technologies. So I do use blogs and wikis for both my research and my teaching. I started out using blogs, and the problem with that is that, you know, if you make a comment on a student post and they go and they correct it, there's no record of that that chain of corrections. And it turns out that for a lot of the assignments that I would give students, it does involve a lot of back and forth between the teacher and the student. And so I started to use a wiki where you can track every version, so the student could write something, and I could write something in bold and italics. And then when they respond to that comment, they can delete my bolded comment. If it's a question of like a paper or writing something up to submit, I definitely do prefer the wiki. But the problem with that is that the RSS feeds are not very user-friendly. So there's kind of a balance to strike. But you have to ask yourself what your objectives are. And for me, the interaction with the student is the most important thing. So, you know, I've recently favored wikis.
Traditionally, I guess blogs use RSS feeds. I don't know how that would work so much with a wiki. What software do you use for blogs and wikis?
Well, for blogs, I still use Blogger. Which is, you know, is great. And I use Wikispaces for the wiki. It's a really nice platform. It's actually free if you're willing to make your data public. So you actually pay to make data private. But I'm a big believer in open access. So for me, it just makes a lot of sense to use Wikispaces. Wikispaces uses the Creative Commons license by attribution by default. So a lot of people might not realize this, but if you want to make your work open, you actually have to put some HTML code on each page so that, you know, search engines like Google, when you specify, you know, I'm looking for material by license, Google will know that that page is actually available for free use.
Oh, you know, that's something that I didn't realize. I know I license mine through Creative Commons, but I just put a notice on the actual page, but are you saying there's a special tag that you put in, or?
Yeah, there's actually HTML that you need to put in. If you go to any of my wikis, or any wiki space for that matter, and you look at the source, you'll see at the very bottom, I think, it has a little code that Google uses.
Okay, cool. I learned something every time I do an interview.
Yeah, it's not talked about. I didn't know about that for a long time, because I was wondering, you know, when I'm searching Google, you don't find a lot of stuff that's open, and I think that's part of the reason. Uh-huh. That, you know, a lot of people want to do it, but they're not sure exactly how. It's a very small snippet of code.
Now, I saw something else on one of your web pages, and it said that you're also interested in teaching chemistry with Second Life. Now, I've touched on Second Life a little bit with my audience. I've dabbled in it myself, but I really haven't used it in teaching, and I'm certainly interested in finding out more about that. So what has been your experience with Second Life, and how have you attempted to use it for teaching?
Well, funny you should mention Second Life. This week, on Tuesday, I give a talk on using Second Life in chemistry, in the chemistry classroom at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia. And that's recorded, so if you're familiar with my podcast, that's the last entry there this week. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, I just show examples in chemistry, how you can create molecules in 3D, how you can view spectra, which are documents that chemists use to tell whether or not, you know, that's the right molecule. There's a lot of things that you can do. Some of it's easy. Some of it's, you know, you think might be easy, but it's actually hard. And what I did in that talk is I basically just explained what is reasonably easy to do. So with a collaborator, Andrew Lang, we basically developed a way to very simply create molecules in Second Life with really minimal knowledge of chemistry or with no coding experience at all. And so it allows me to give assignments to students and not have to, you know, worry about showing them how to do scripting and stuff like that. So there's a lot of exciting things for chemistry in Second Life right now. It's definitely a good time to get in.
So do you use the native tools that they give you in Second Life, or is this some sort of special tool to create molecules?
It's a special tool for creating molecules. There are ways of representing molecules with strings of text, like smiles, for example. And those you can obtain pretty easily on the internet, you know, using free software. You can generate them pretty easily. So a student can draw a molecule, find out the smiles for it, and then copy and paste it into Second Life. And there are these objects called resers in Second Life that do things. And this particular reser that's called an ORAC, actually will create the molecule if you paste the Smiles code in the chat box. So that's really extremely simple, and the students just need to know where to grab the ORAC. And my collaborator, Andy, you know, wrote the script for that. So there's a lot of really good collaborations in Second Life. That's one of the reasons that I keep going back there, because you meet people who have similar interests, and everybody has a slightly different skill set. So Andy, for example, is a mathematician, and he had written this code for a different purpose. But because we can interact pretty easily, you can use tools and reuse them in different fields and different contexts.
Uh-huh. Now, are you just still experimenting with this? Have you actually used it in a class? And if so, I know it's fairly steep learning curve. How have your students adapted to using it?
Well, I've used it in a couple of different ways. I mean, the way that I just talked about now, which is students do assignments, that's sort of an extra credit that the students can do. And if you put a link in your notes there, I can give you a link to the wiki and a couple of examples of those, you know, what they look like. Uh-huh. And so, for example, a student was trying to show the effect of mirror images in chemistry. And so he created two molecules that are mirror images of each other and that are pretty complex, that are kind of hard to see on paper, but in Second Life, you can make the molecule bigger than yourself, right. So you can view it in a different way. So that's one way. The other way that I've used it for many terms now is to do quizzes and races. So there are these obelisks that you click on them and it pops up four images, and three of the images will be incorrect. And if you click on the correct image, you get another set of images that, you know, relate to organic chemistry somehow.
I see.
Uh-huh. And so I can do races. I could have, you know, several students start at the same time, and the first one who finishes, I give them a prize, typically like a molecular model kit or something like that. That's worked out pretty well. It's a self-selected group, so they're not getting graded on this. They're competing for a prize. So If you have a student that, you know, would not be interested in Second Life, they wouldn't show up. If you ask me, do students like it or not? Well, by definition, don't show up. Do like it, but. You know, remember I talked about those workshops. That's another useful way to use them, is to actually have the students bring the computer and help them to do things like set up an account on Second Life, which is really pretty simple and quick if you know what to do. It can be a little daunting if you're not computer savvy at all.
Right.
So that's been very helpful. But certainly, yeah, the Second Life experience varies a lot depending on how you're introduced to it.
Right.
And a lot of people just don't even have a destination. They just go on Second Life, and you end up in this orientation island, and you don't know what to do, and this machine is telling you to do things, these new people around, and nobody knows what's going on. So that's a totally different experience than if your chemistry teacher invites you on Drexel Island and shows you a quiz. So those are two different experiences. And I think Second Life can work well, you know, if you give students guidance.
Is there anybody else you can think of as doing some clever things with Second Life?
We have about 30 groups that have some online presence on Drexel Island. There's actually a wiki, drexelisland.wikispaces.com, and there's a list of all the different groups in the university that are doing something. Mm-hmm. Some people think of it as like having an office. It's a way of showing your department or showing your college or whatever, showing your lab. And so it's a way to, you can think of it like a website in that way, as being a pretty static thing. Or you can do things that are more interactive, like I mentioned quizzes, I mentioned molecules. You can show chemical reactions where you actually talk to the molecules and they react. So there's some pretty neat things that you can do. So if you have a chance, definitely stop by. I'll give you a tour.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I can imagine it's almost mandatory for a school like Drexel to have a presence on Second Life. I imagine it's going to be probably a good recruiting tool as well.
Yeah. Actually, the admissions was one of the first people to get involved. So, yeah, it's another tool. It's not a website. So if you try to treat it too much like a website, you're gonna be disappointed. But if you leverage its strengths, and I think one of the biggest strengths of Second Life is really the networking. If my students are doing a project, that's great. But if they're doing a project in Second Life and they get to meet another chemistry student in Australia, that is potentially much more valuable. And that really does happen a lot in Second Life. You do meet like-minded people.
Well, listen, I think we're just about out of time. I really appreciate having you talk to my audience. I think they should be really interested in going to some of your sites and learning more about what you do. Perhaps I can have you come back again and fill us in on some of the latest ventures that you're involved with in e-learning.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview. That's about all I have for today. Stay tuned for the full song, Too Long by Yael Naim. Until next time, have a great week.
Please leave odd feedback at 610-616-2199.
For so long outside myself, you see, I was pretending to be someone else. I was longing to see who I wanted to be. And I've been waiting on my own. Oh,
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Please don't forget to leave Rod feedback. You can go to www.rodspulsepodcast.com and leave comments on his blog. You can send feedback to his email address, rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. You can also send audio feedback by calling into his comment line at 610-616-2199. Till next time, have a great week.
The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Merry, and does not represent the official viewpoint of Thomas Jefferson University, or any other institution or company.